Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. With all of our angst over the current state of politics, this seems like a good time to revisit a simpler era. The idyllic days known as the 90s. Remember this?
I'm not sitting here as some little woman standing by my man like Tammy Wynette. And you know, if that's not enough for people, then heck, don't vote for him.
And this?
This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching.
What about this?
We're here because we are taking the first steps, and we're taking them in a contract with the American people.
And don't forget this.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Joining me today to discuss those not-so-simpler times is Steve Kornacki, national political correspondent at NBC News and MSNBC. His first book, The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism, has just been published. In it, Kornacki explores many of the seeds sowing our current political discontent, from controversies and battles over race and gender to heated rhetoric over the impartiality of the Supreme Court. Kornacki describes the 90s as an era whose, quote, dominant features were confrontation, gridlock, polarization, and a new kind of tribalism, end quote. My, how things haven't changed. Steve Kornacki, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to this.
So congratulations on the book. It's already receiving a lot of praise. Let's start with your title. You write about how the presidential election night maps, I should say, on TV used red and blue interchangeably until 2000. And then we got Bush v. Gore. So how and why did red and blue become our universal shorthand for partisan politics?
Yeah, I mean, that's the inspiration for the title of the book, and it can feel like those colors have been with us forever. The idea of red America, blue America, red states, blue states, and they really are, you know, sort of something that was put in place in people's minds, as you're saying, by the 2000 election. I mean, and one of the things that was true really in the generation leading up to that 2000 election is we didn't have a lot of close presidential races in this country, so the colors just kind of didn't matter at all. Ronald Reagan won 49 states, Richard Nixon won 49 states, Bush Sr. won 40. So, you know, networks would kind of randomly assign a color, some years blue for the Republicans, some years red for the Democrats, and it would be one blob of, you know, whatever the Republican color was. That tended to be the story. And in 2000, though, we had the closest thing this country has ever seen to a perfect tie in a presidential election, maybe the closest thing we'll ever see to a perfect tie. And suddenly people looked at that map, and they had, by the way, 36 days to look at it because there
they
was
did
a recount
indeed
after that election. And there was you could see those divisions just so clearly. The entire South, wall-to-wall red, the Northeast, deep blue, the Pacific Coast, blue, a little bit in the Midwest, the places, you know, around the Chicago suburbs, Detroit suburbs, that area, you know, turning blue. And people kind of looked at it, processed all of these divisions that had taken hold. There was a moment a couple weeks after the 2000 election during that recount when David Letterman on his show on CBS said, you know, I got a solution to this whole impasse we have right here. Why don't we just let Al Gore be the president of those blue states, George W. Bush the president of those red states? And I feel like that kind of captured the divide that had taken hold. And really, that is the divide, I think, that we've been left with ever since in our politics.
Yeah, the book begins and ends with that 2000 election, but much of the heart of it is delving into the circumstances that led to the ascendancy of the two major figures from the 90s. And, of course, that's Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. And we've seen these characters for so long that it's gotten lost for a lot of us, I think, how improbable both of their rises were. Going back into their earlier careers, the early part of their careers, what resonated most with you in terms of that unusual path each one of them took?
Yeah, right. It is. I think it is the collision between a President Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich kind of being the leader of Republicans in Congress. It's that collision that really creates eventually all of those divisions that produce that map at the end of the decade. And what I think is important to realize about both of them is that they each did something that was considered at the time close to impossible for their parties. Newt Gingrich overthrew what was called the Permanent Democratic Congress. It had been 40 years when he became House Speaker after the 1994 elections and Republicans became the majority party. It had been 40 years since Republicans had controlled the House. I mean, when you think about that, you know, we have elections coming up in a few weeks. Maybe Democrats will hit that magic number. Maybe they won't. But we all know it's doable. Nobody will be surprised if control of the House shifts. And won't be the first time in recent memory control of the House has shifted. It's done, you know, a few times just in the last generation. But in 1994, when that happened, it was a 54-seat gain for Republicans. It was thought to be uncharted terrain in American politics. People contemplated whether it meant the end of the Democratic Party, the end of liberalism. It was assumed it would be the end of Bill Clinton. And that was the product of just years and years of maneuvering on the part of Newt Gingrich behind the scenes, just an utterly improbable rise from the back benches of a minority party, just buried deep in the minority to that moment. And that was Newt. And the Bill Clinton part of the story is, you know, what was supposed to be impossible for Democrats as the 1990s dawned was winning a presidential election. The term that was in vogue at the start of the 1990s was that there was a Republican lock on the presidency, an electoral lock. And like I said, you'd seen Nixon win 49 states, Reagan 49, Bush Sr. 40. You had landslide after landslide after landslide. In a way, we don't now. You have a solid, you know, a solid victory in a presidential election now looks like, you know, Barack Obama in 2008 or 2012. Those aren't landslides by the standard I'm talking about here. That was what Democrats were up against really for an entire generation from the late 1960s on. And so Bill Clinton, when he emerged in 1992, it was James Carville, you know, one of his campaign strategists after the election, who talked about how his campaign had picked the Republican lock on the Electoral College. It was still seen that
it's
way.
The economy, yeah. Stupid.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you had these two, and it was just that collision. It was Gingrich leading the Republicans to a place they thought they couldn't get, Clinton leading Democrats to a place they thought they couldn't get, and the two of them and the two of those forces kind of colliding.
Again, we're speaking with MSNBC's Steve Kornacki, who is the author of The Red and the Blue. You go into even more detail in the book. For example, with Newt Gingrich, part of his rise was fueled by the fact that Trent Lott decides to run for the Senate. Dick Cheney, then a congressman, is tapped to run the Pentagon in the Bush administration. And on the flip side, when Bill Clinton launches his improbable run in 1992, everyone is thinking that Mario Cuomo will have the nomination if he enters the race. And so those dominoes fall in the right ways for Gingrich and Clinton. Otherwise, we're having an entirely different conversation here.
One of the things I love about history are the what-ifs. And in writing this book and thinking about the last, you know, generation or so of American politics, that's what struck me. There are a couple of pivot point moments where we've all forgotten about the moment, and we may not have even noticed the significance of it at the time. But when you look back and you say, geez, what if things had gone just a little bit differently? And right, I mean, the big one I build to is with Bill Clinton and Mario Cuomo. And it's this great ideological battle, great personality battle that never quite actually happened, but everybody thought was going to happen for years. And it was the Democratic Party emerging from, you know, all of those landslide defeats in presidential elections, absorbing one loss after another and trying to figure out what to do. And there were, you know, two very different directions there that were sort of embodied by Cuomo and Clinton. And Cuomo, of course, had given this famous convention speech in 1984, at the Democratic Convention in San Francisco. To folks who don't remember it, I liken it to that speech Barack Obama gave at the Democratic Convention.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and Obama rode that all the way to the presidency, and there were Democrats just begging Mario Cuomo after that speech, for years after that speech, please run, please run. You know, 7 years after that speech, in the fall of 1991, he's flirting with entering the presidential race. And polls show if he gets in, he's going to be 40 points ahead. Everybody's going to endorse him. He's going to just all the cash is going to flow, and he's going to be the overwhelming Democratic frontrunner. And at the same time, the guy who is running while Cuomo contemplates all of this is Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton is sort of stylistically, ideologically, the opposite of Mario Cuomo. You know, Cuomo is a liberal from New York. Clinton is trying to identify himself as a centrist from the South who can win back that part of the country for Democrats. And it looks like this incredible battle is shaping up where Clinton's going to have to run to the right. He's going to have to convince Democrats to reject where maybe their heart is with a guy like Cuomo and try to sell them on some kind of pragmatism. And it builds and it builds to this day, December 20th, 1991. I think it's a hinge point of history. Mario Cuomo is has to make up his mind. It's the filing deadline for the New Hampshire primary. He's in his statehouse office in Albany. He charters a plane. It is idling on the tarmac of the Albany airport. It can fly him in about 45 minutes to New Hampshire to file his paperwork. CNN, which is, you know, sort of about a decade old at that point, has a camera trained on the plane all day. People are tuning in to see, you know, does the governor walk onto that plane and ride into history or not. And he ends up, he decides not to. He just, his heart wasn't in it. He doesn't run. And it just, it changes everything for Bill Clinton because he doesn't have to run against Cuomo. He doesn't have to run to the middle in the Democratic primaries when he's hit with all of these scandals, Jennifer Flowers, the Vietnam draft a few weeks later. You know, there's no Cuomo there to just, for Democratic voters to kind of flee to. They were still sort of stuck with Bill Clinton. And, you know, I just, it's one of those I think back to over and over again. If Cuomo gets on that plane, the entire last generation of Democratic politics was defined by Bill and Hillary. Hillary Clinton was defined in part by, you know, the sexual politics that came with Bill Clinton. How different is our history if Mario Cuomo gets on that plane?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I want to play you a clip from a circumstance that you outline in the book, which is how Newt Gingrich began to get the attention of his fellow Republicans in Congress. This is a confrontation involving then-Speaker Tip O'Neill.
You deliberately stood on that well before an emptied house and challenged these people, and you challenged their Americanism. And it's the lowest thing that I've ever seen in my 32 years in Congress.
Mr. Speaker, if I may reclaim my time, let me say, first of all,
I move that we take the Speaker's words down.
The Chair feels that that type of characterization should not be used in debate.
After the chair's ruling.
Now, Steve, we only have a little bit of time left in this segment, so we'll pick it up after this. But can you start with maybe just a short synopsis of how shocking that was for a no-name congressman from Georgia in the Republican Party to be confronting Tip O'Neill at that time?
Yeah, that's the spring of 1984, and Newt Gingrich is in his third term, and even his own fellow Republican colleagues don't take him that seriously. And that was him baiting the face of the Democratic Party, the face of the permanent Democratic majority, Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, into a fight on the House floor. And it ends with O'Neill essentially getting reprimanded and Newt Gingrich walking out of that chamber to a standing ovation from Republicans. And I think that was the turning point, a big one in Newt Gingrich's rise in Washington and American politics.
When, as I said, we're coming up on the break. So when we come back, I want to delve into Newt Gingrich's rise a little bit more because he is every bit as important to this story as Bill and Hillary Clinton are. Also, while we have Steve Kornacki here from MSNBC, of course, we're going to put him to work forecasting the midterms, including that close race in the 9th District in North Carolina. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute with Steve Kornacki talking about the red and the blue here on Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest is Steve Kornacki, who is a national political correspondent at NBC News and MSNBC. He has just published his first book, and it is a fascinating look at how the politics of the 1990s shaped so much of our current debates and attitudes. It's called The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. So when we stepped away, you were reacting to that clip of Newt Gingrich being rebuked by then-Speaker Tip O'Neill. One of the things that this book does really well is it reminds us how comparatively tame so many of the policy fights and debates on taxes and other issues tended to be at that time, and how Gingrich, more than anyone, changed that. You had people like Bob Michael, who was the Republican majority or minority leader, I should say. He retired. And then you had others like Bob Dole, who all of a sudden become hardliners. They're not as willing to compromise. So tell me a little bit about how Newt Gingrich managed to recast the shape and the tenor of the Republican Party.
Right. I mean, Newt Gingrich changes the Republican Party and makes it into something, you know, close to what we recognize today, certainly puts it on track for what we have today. When Newt Gingrich comes to the House in 1978, like I was saying before the break, he is considered a gadfly by his fellow Republicans. And Republicans are buried deep in the minority at that point. We don't go to election saying, geez, are the Republicans going to get the majority this year? Are they going to come close? It's just assumed that the Democrats are going to maintain the majority. The Speaker's gavel is handed down like a hereditary instrument. And Gingrich is basically looking at this and saying, well, geez, you know, Republicans are winning presidential elections, you know, easily. Richard Nixon, you know, had just won 49 states over George McGovern in 72. And the Gingrich theory is, you know, we need to nationalize politics. We need to make every voter in the country see in the Democratic candidate in their backyard the face of George McGovern, the face of the National Democratic Party they don't seem to want to vote for. Because politics, you know, obviously, it was the Tip O'Neill famous saying that all politics is local, and that was typically, you know, what happened. People would respond to issues in their community. You know, the suburbs in one area might be Republican because of tensions with the city next door or vice versa, but it wasn't nationalized. And Gingrich's idea was nationalize it. Make every election at every level of the ballot a referendum on the two parties, and then make the distinction between the two parties sharp, bright, and clear. And he said the Republicans need to be, he said they need to offer a conservative opportunity society, that vision of America as a conservative opportunity society versus a Democratic Party that he said represented a liberal welfare state. He wanted that to be the basic division, and he said Republicans in the House should be using every vote, every debate on the floor, every parliamentary tool as a way of advancing that contrast. And that was a dramatic and just total departure from the way the House had been run, the way Congress had been run. The idea of a gentleman's club had long prevailed. There'd been fights, there'd been battles, there'd been tensions in Congress, but there was room for bipartisanship. There was also room for friendship and socializing and relationships between the members. You mentioned Bob Michael. Bob Michael is the Republican minority leader while Newt is making his climb. And Bob Michael's nickname was literally Mr. Nice Guy. That's what they called him.
That's right.
He was poker buddies. He played poker with Tip O'Neill. He went golfing with Tip O'Neill. He went to a testimonial dinner for Tip O'Neill, threw his arm around him, said, I love this man. And Newt wanted none of that. And Newt was, you know, that clip you just showed. It was Newt, you know, hectoring Tip O'Neill, baiting him into a debate on the floor, getting O'Neill to boil over, and then getting Republicans to see what that felt like. What did it feel like as this party that had been in the minority for 30 years, that didn't think it could get out of that, to sit there on the House floor and watch the face of the opposition get reprimanded, you know, basically get owned in a debate by Newt Gingrich? Kind of felt good to some of them. And they started hearing it from their voters. They started getting letters and phone calls and hearing from it at events locally, you know, basically asking them, why aren't you fighting like this guy? And more, Gingrich was able to win over converts. He got folks around the country running for office, you know, to basically with the idea of coming to Washington to join him. And just over time, over a decade and a half, he changed the face of that Republican conference. And it became, you know, what you'd call a Gingrichized conference. And then you get a Democratic president in 93, you know, Bill Clinton comes in, and Bill Clinton at that point confronts a Republican opposition that is very different than any opposition a Democratic president's ever faced before.
Well, and you go through the foreshadowing, if you will, of how Gingrich will take on Clinton when you go back to the relatively minor episode that led to the downfall of then House Speaker Jim Wright, which was this book that he had written and how Newt Gingrich went after him in terms of ethics, possible ethics violations, and he pushes and pushes and pushes, and eventually Jim Wright resigns.
Yep, this is a major moment for Newt Gingrich, and I think for American politics, I go deep on a lot of these episodes in Gingrich's rise because I think you can see I hope echoes of where we are today, but also you can see the roots of it really. And what Gingrich saw was he saw ethics, the idea of ethics violations, the idea of accusing your opponent of corruption. He saw that as a powerful political tool, and that idea of sharp contrast between the parties. Part of that, a big part of that, was making the Democratic Party the party of corruption. The party, you know, he would call it the corrupt Democrat machine, the broken Democrat machine. And so you had this situation where the House Speaker, who succeeds Tip O'Neill in the late 1980s, Jim Wright from Texas, Jim Wright had written a book. He was getting paid. To call it a book maybe is generous. It really was like
well,
a
yeah, that's true. Fair
you know,
point.
You weren't going to your local bookstore outside of Fort right. Worth, Texas, and finding it. But in his district, this pamphlet got passed around. And what happened was he got a 55% royalty on every individual sale of this thing. And so what it really was, if you were a friend, if you were a donor, if you were somebody in the district who wanted to sort of show your appreciation for Jim Wright, you buy his pamphlet. He gets 55% of it. You know, it looked like a cute way around all of these regulations on House members enriching themselves, and raised all sorts of questions about donors' influence and that sort of thing. So Gingrich saw in that a weapon to make Jim Wright the face of corruption, and he starts going after him. And the critical thing that changes, I think this is part of the story too, is that unlike Tip O'Neill, Republicans didn't like Jim Wright. You know, Tip O'Neill was a storyteller. Tip O'Neill could tell a good joke, and Republicans might not have liked him politically, but they liked him personally. And the kinds of attacks that Gingrich launched on Jim Wright, if he launched them against Tip O'Neill, that level of personal vitriol, and accusation of malfeasance, I don't think Republicans would have stood for it back then. But Jim Wright, they didn't like him. Jim Wright took that majority, that massive Democratic majority, and he was running roughshod over the Republicans. He's holding votes open for, long after the time has expired, twisting arms, getting Democrats to change their votes, anything to win. And it really, really irks Republicans. And so when Gingrich starts going after Jim Wright, the Republicans do not rein him in. They let him go because they kind of like seeing it. And it builds and it builds. It takes a year and a half. And basically in June of 1989, Jim Wright is forced to resign. And it's the first time in history that a House Speaker has been forced out on ethics violations, ethics accusations. And Wright gives this speech. It's an amazing moment to go back and look at right now, his resignation speech, that the House chamber is full. Gingrich is right near the front on the Republican side. And Wright discusses, he says, "This is not the House I came to." And he's talking about, the campaign Gingrich has waged against him. He talks about, we trusted each other's word. If a member said he was honorable, that was good enough for us. And he says, he frames his resignation as a sacrifice. He says, "Consider my resignation a sacrifice so that we might cleanse from this chamber what has infected it." And he's talking about Newt Gingrich. It's this moment when you look back at it now, and obviously our politics continued right on that same track, but right in that moment, some part of him thought he might be putting an end to it.
That's the voice of Steve Kornacki. He is a national political correspondent for MSNBC and NBC News, and he's the author of the new book, The Red and the Blue, and we're talking a lot about the 1990s and how that era shaped our current political culture. I wanted to add a postscript, which of course you know as well as I do, Steve, which is the fact that Newt Gingrich himself as Speaker would end up having to sacrifice a $4 million book advance because of possible ethics violations. So I guess what comes around goes around, right?
And not only that, then he also was the subject himself of a years-long ethics investigation over this political action committee that he ran called GOPAC, and it finally resulted in 1997. He was fined $300,000 by the Senate House Ethics Committee. He ended up having to borrow the money to pay for it from Bob Dole. Bob Dole, who was then a former senator, offered him a loan, and Gingrich agreed to it. But it was almost exactly the same thing that happened to Wright. happened to Gingrich, where Democrats saw in his own, he had a book deal. The first thing he mentioned was a book deal, $4.5 million advance when he became Speaker. He had to give that up. It looked like shades of Jim Wright. And then there was this separate, you know, years-long ethics investigation that ends in his reprimand and ends in a fine for him. He didn't have to step down over that. He barely hung on. But absolutely, he introduced that form of politics, and then it was turned against him.
And by the way, the book deal was with HarperCollins, owned by Rupert Murdoch, who, of course, started Fox News. So everything is connected. I want to ask you.
And I should say, too, my publisher is Echo, which is owned by HarperCollins.
That's right. So that's right.
That in there too.
Good point. So we're, you know, watch out. Congress may be looking at this closely. In case anyone needs convincing that there's nothing new in politics, I want to read this quote that you included from the 1992 New Hampshire Republican primary, and it's from remarks made by Pat Buchanan, the former Nixon aide who had turned pundit at that point, and he had challenged his party's incumbent president, George H.W. Bush. Here is what Pat Buchanan said. Quote, "We are going to take our party back from those who have walked away from us and forgotten about us, and when we have taken our party back, we are going to take our country back. When we take America back, we are going to make America great again, because there is nothing wrong with putting America first." So my question for you is, how much did Buchanan's sentiment sort of go dormant within the Republican Party over the next two decades before Donald Trump brought that sentiment roaring back to life in 2016?
Right. I feel like, you know, the footsteps of Donald Trump in 2016, of the Donald Trump we know now, you can hear them with Pat Buchanan. You can hear them approaching in the 1990s. And you mentioned word for word, make America great again. I mean, think about this platform.
America first. I mean, it's eerie.
Yeah, economic nationalism. Pat Buchanan was the first to call for a border wall. He wanted a wall on the entire southern border to stop illegal immigration from Mexico. He railed against multiculturalism, political correctness. He talked about reviving American manufacturing by tearing up unfair trade deals. It was the same message pitched at, you know, the same voters. And what happened in the 1990s with Pat Buchanan, especially in 1996, he ran for president three times in the decade. But in 1996, to me, is the most interesting one, because in 96, Bob Dole was the Republican front runner, and it was assumed that Phil Gramm, the, you know, senator from Texas at the time, would be the main conservative alternative to Dole. And Buchanan forced his way into the conversation. Buchanan showed that there was a market for this message that I'm describing and that we now recognize as Trumpism, that there was a much, much bigger market for that, particularly on the Republican side, than anybody in the Republican Party had thought. And with this kind of platform, he attracted some fringe support, you know, from the far right, from people like David Duke, which, of course, made Republican establishment leaders very nervous and made them try to distance themselves from Pat Buchanan. So we saw that whole dance. But Buchanan, in the 96 primaries, he nearly beat Dole in Iowa, and Dole had been considered unbeatable in Iowa. And then 8 days later, Buchanan rolls into New Hampshire and wins the New Hampshire primary. And there's this unbelievable moment. He gives this this victory speech that night. Pat Buchanan was a wordsmith. He's a, you know, former columnist and speechwriter. He's giving this jubilant victory speech. He has this famous line where he says, you know, he says that the fax machines in Washington are going to be buzzing as the Republican establishment, you know, scrambles to come up with a strategy to stop him. And then he likens his supporters around the country to, you know, to troops awaiting his command. And he says, "My command to you is mount up and ride to the sound of the guns." And there's this moment when the Republican establishment fears that Buchananism is going to take over the party and that they're not going to be able to stop it. Now, they're able to. It's the South Carolina primary. They all rally around Dole. Dole beats Buchanan, and that's kind of it for Buchanan in 96. But it's there. And I think it didn't have a leader like Buchanan or a leader like Trump who was giving voice to it. You saw bits and pieces of it in the 20 years in between. I think, you know, Ron Paul got a piece of it, but not all of it. You saw certain, you know, sort of cultural conservatives get a piece of it, but not all of it. But Trump comes along 2015, 2016, and it is in some cases word for word the Buchanan platform. And the added piece of it is, the third Buchanan campaign in the 90s is when he bolts the Republican Party and runs for the Reform Party nomination in 99 and 2000. The guy who briefly steps forward to challenge him and to denounce him is Donald Trump. So well, a different version of Trump ran against Trumpism.
That's right. And I was going to ask you about that because that too was fascinating. And I think a lot of us had probably forgotten about this. But at the time, the former wrestler turned Minnesota governor, Jesse Ventura, was flying the flag for the Reform Party. He was trying to get Donald Trump to run for president. And you mentioned several of the nuances here, including Trump at one point saying he would love to have Oprah Winfrey run with him. And at another point, Donald Trump writes an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal asserting that non-politicians represent the wave of the future. So there is all kinds of foreshadowing going on there. What do you make of Trump 1999 versus Trump 2018?
In a lot of ways, the Trump who sort of ran for president in 99-2000, he never declared, but he was out there doing all the things he did in 2015 and 2016. In a lot of ways, he's the same Trump we know today. The bluster, the swagger, the insults, the inflammatory rhetoric. He would, you know, reporters would ask him how his campaign is going. He'd say, it's great, having seen the latest poll, we're ahead. They'd say, you know, what poll are you talking about? He'd say, it was in the National Enquirer. You know, so we saw that Trump, that version of him. That was very much the same. The difference, though, was, like I'm saying, strikingly opposite ideologically where he ended up being in 2015 and 2016. You had Buchanan out there winning over support from approval from, you know, the far right forces like, you know, David Duke. David Duke in 99-2000 was also out there saying he wanted Pat Buchanan to get elected president. And Donald Trump was out there saying that it was unconscionable that Pat Buchanan would not denounce and distance himself forcefully from David Duke. Donald Trump called Pat Buchanan an anti-Semite. He called him a Hitler lover. He called him a racist. He said he couldn't understand people who would support the Pat Buchanan message. They're a far-right fringe, and he said it may not even be far-right. It's just fringe. He took a visit, Trump did, to something called the Museum of Tolerance out in Los Angeles. And Trump toured the museum, came out and told the press that he thought Pat Buchanan should come visit it too, because maybe Pat would learn something. So he is the sort of reaction that Pat Buchanan, with his platform and his rhetoric, inspired, particularly from the fringes on the right. Donald Trump could not have been more clear in 1999 and 2000 in separating himself from that, distancing himself from it, denouncing it. In fact, it builds to this moment in February 2000 when Donald Trump decides.
Steve, let me interrupt you. We're going to pick up right after the break. That's Steve Kornacki. You're going to hear the rest of the story. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks.
I'm Mike Collins. North Carolina voters will be deciding the course of state and national politics in the upcoming midterm. Join us for an election special Tuesday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. live from the Booth Playhouse in Founders Hall. More details at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest is Steve Kornacki, who is the author of the new book, The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. I unintentionally created a cliffhanger there. Steve, I'm sorry for interrupting you. So continue with Donald Trump in the 1990s and how that led into the present, if you don't mind.
Sure. No. I like the cliffhanger too. the Trump campaign for the Reform Party nomination in 99 and 2000 against Pat Buchanan, it culminates in February 2000 with Donald Trump finally having to make up his mind. And the rules of the Reform Party were different than the Democrats and the Republicans. The nomination was given out only at a convention. There were no primaries, no caucuses. So you had to go around the country basically recruiting people, signing them up through state party conventions, local conventions, to become delegates. In other words, it required a real, true, well-organized effort. And Buchanan on that front was just swamping Trump. Buchanan was organized. They had this thing lined up top to bottom. You know, Trump was a more media-fueled phenomenon, as we saw again 16 years
Understatement later. Understatement so, of the century, yes.
And so Trump was getting nowhere on the delegate front, and I don't know what he thought of the polls. The polls outside the National Enquirer weren't looking that good. So he pulls the plug. And he pulls the plug with an op-ed in the New York Times in February 2000, where he writes about the experience of running for president, essentially. And he says that he loved it, but he was deeply concerned by what he saw in the Reform Party, because he saw Buchanan making alliances with far-right figures, with racists, with anti-Semites, and he said in the end he could not stomach being part of a political movement that would attract those sorts of people. This is what he writes in the New York Times. And then he closes the op-ed by saying, again, though, that overall he loved the experience, and he loved it so much, in fact, that maybe he'll run for president again someday.
It really is uncanny, all of these historical coincidences that you document in the book. I wanted to ask you, at the beginning, we played one of the most famous moments from the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings in 1991. And, of course, we're coming off the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, which have been equally divisive, if not more so. I'm wondering, in 1992, as you well know, we had the Year of the Woman, where all these women ran for office. They won at record levels. Women voted, turned out. They were angry and frustrated. There are a lot of people who believe that is going to happen again this year. This week, we had a CNN poll that found a 39-point gender gap when it comes to views on President Trump. When you look at all that, what do you see happening here in these midterms, particularly when it comes to women?
I mean, I think we'd already been seeing a 2018 version of the 1992 Year of the Woman even before the Kavanaugh hearings, because what the 92 Year of the Woman was marked by was record mobilization of women as candidates, as activists, as donors, and it particularly disrupted the Democratic Party in 92. You know, the first big eruption of the 92 Year of the Woman was Carol Moseley Braun in a primary in Illinois beating a Democratic senator, Alan Dixon, who had voted for Clarence Thomas's nomination. And so most of the disruption and the bulk of the sort of new candidate emergence came on the Democratic side in 92. And it did result at the time in a record number of women running for office. They went from, in the Senate, they went from two women to six women in the 92 election. And that was enough that the day after the election, George Mitchell, the Senate majority leader at the time, held a press conference and said he decided he was going to install a women's restroom for the first time.
Oh my gosh.
So that was one of the results of the 1992 Year of the Woman. Now in 2018, even before Kavanaugh, we had already been seeing the same phenomenon, but on a much greater scale. The number of women mobilizing, running for office in 2017, 2018 has been off the charts, certainly compared to 92, but compared to any other election in history, to the point that if you just look at the open races for U.S. House, where there's no incumbent, you know, so it's a sort of a free shot for anybody who wants it. In those races on the Democratic side, 50% of their nominees this year are male, and 50% are female. They've got parity when it comes to these open seat races. That's historically, you know, a new frontier for them. And again, like I said, in 92, it was heavily sort of concentrated on the Democratic side. It's the same in 2018. There are women out there running, new female candidates running on the Republican side. It's not a Democrats only phenomenon, but it's a Democrats heavy phenomenon in 2018. And I imagine the Kavanaugh hearings are only going to intensify that, or at least reinforce it.
Again, that's the voice of Steve Kornacki. He is the MSNBC and NBC News national political correspondent and author of the new book, The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. I wanted to ask you about, a school of thought that is out there now that says because of the, backlash to the backlash over the Kavanaugh hearings, that maybe Republicans will now be more motivated to go to the polls and perhaps blunt or override the belief by some that there will be a blue wave. What do you think about that?
I'm open to the possibility, and I'm looking for, you know, what the data shows us. What I'm seeing right now in the data is a strong suggestion that at least when it comes to U.S. Senate races, we might be seeing something like that in this moment. The important thing to keep in mind here is that when we're talking about U.S. Senate races, you know, we're not talking about every state. We're only talking about a handful of states. And those states that are the battleground for the Senate tend to be, just because of the way it worked out this year, they tend to be Trump states. That's where the battleground is on the Senate side. So if there is a sort of anti-backlash backlash, whatever you want to call it, coming from Kavanaugh that has energized the Republican base, the Senate would be the place where you would definitely see that, because the races are in, you know, Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat, is trying to hang on in North Dakota. Trump won it by 36 points. You know, McCaskill in Missouri, Trump won it by 20 points. Those are the kinds of states that are the battleground. And we have been seeing movement, you know, in Tennessee, for instance. There's Democrats have been hoping that Phil Bredesen, you know, former governor, could win that seat. They had him up in polls over the summer. Our own NBC poll in that race had him up a couple points about a month ago. I've now seen two polls in that race since the Kavanaugh drama really kind of spiked that have the Republican Marsha Blackburn ahead by 5 and by 8 points.
But have you factored in Taylor Swift yet? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, right. That's is there a backlash to that, maybe? And, you know, everything in politics is a reaction to something, right? And then a reaction to the reaction. But yeah, seeing that in Tennessee, you know, saw another poll with Cruz in Texas, you know, up 5-6 points. We have a new NBC poll out of Nevada yesterday. Now, Nevada is a Clinton state by about 2 points in 2016, but it's a battleground state. Our poll showed Dean Heller, the Republican, pulling ahead by 2 points. That's an improvement for him. So we're getting some indications on the Senate side of what you're describing. And obviously it raises the question, if it's there, will it last till November? But if it is real and if it is enduring, and it does save the Senate for Republicans and even lead to some gains there, that does not foreclose the possibility, and some would even say likelihood, that the story will be entirely different when it comes to the U.S. House. Because unlike the Senate, the House is being waged, the battle for the House is being waged in every precinct of the country. And that's going to cover a lot of that suburban terrain where Democrats think the politics of Kavanaugh and the politics of the last 2 years really works to their advantage.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the House, because as I said earlier, I wanted to get your perspective on the race here that is getting a lot of national attention, which is the 9th Congressional District in North Carolina, which is a race between Dan McCready, who's a centrist Democrat, first-time candidate, running against Mark Harris, his Republican, former pastor, and, of course, the incumbent was defeated in the primary. This is a traditionally Republican district. What do you expect in that particular race?
This is an interesting one, because when Pittenger lost in the primary to Harris, I think nationally looking at this, I know I changed my view of the race, and a lot of people I know who watch these nationally changed their view too, because the assumption was that this was a potentially winnable district for Democrats, especially given the climate of 2018, and that Mark Harris in at least parts of this district would not be a good fit. It would be a candidate who might be ripe for some attacks that wouldn't have worked against Pittenger, and that might strengthen the Democrats' hand. There was also a sense that McCready was a very good recruit, especially with his, you know, military background, that he would be a very good recruit for Democrats. So it has been very much on my radar since that primary. I will say that the polling that I've seen out of it recently, and specifically there was a New York Times Siena poll out of there in the last week. They've been polling all of these House races around the country, and very interesting work they're doing. It showed Harris actually ahead by, I think it was 5 or 6 points. I think it was a 5-point margin for Harris in that poll. And one of the things that struck me is, and there's still a month to go in the campaign, but Harris's favorable, unfavorable rating in the poll, it looked identical to McCready's. There was not any evidence of Harris being especially polarizing, having an especially high negative view. Now, again, that could change with advertising in the last month. That could change with the any developments in the last month of the race. A lot of money gets spent late in these things. But right now, I think it's safe to say that based on the polling we're seeing, Harris is looking a little stronger there than folks nationally suspected he might.
If Democrats take back the House, what do you think the likelihood is that leadership pursues impeachment against Donald Trump?
The likelihood that they will be pressured to do it, I think, is 100%. Whether they actually do it, I think, is going to depend on the biggest wild card is Robert Mueller, and what does he hand them? If he does what Ken Starr did in 1998, when Ken Starr came to Congress and said, "I have found 11 potentially impeachable offenses committed by Bill Clinton," and Republicans said, "Okay, we'll impeach." If Mueller did anything along those lines with Trump, I think Democrats in the majority instantly, you know, move on it, or almost instantly move on it. Short of that, though, where you've not been presented by some investigative body with some, you know, specific accusation of this impeachable offense or that impeachable offense, I think it's something that candidates for president will make a lot of noise about, that Democratic activists will make a lot of noise about, that different committees in, you know, different Democratic-led committees in the House would pursue investigations over. But I don't think leadership would embrace it, short of having, you know, something like Republicans had in 1998 with Clinton.
I'm curious for your perspective about Newt Gingrich and Donald Trump in this context. As you lay out in the book, Newt Gingrich was the mastermind behind the current version of the Republican Party, not only policies but tactics. And yet, while he became Speaker of the House, his political career kind of fizzled out, and Donald Trump winds up becoming president. Is it as simple as saying, when you're trying to compare these two politicians, that Donald Trump was the better politician because he became president? Or do you think he doesn't get to where he is without Newt Gingrich first?
Yeah, I think they're very much related. I think Trump won because he got to run in the world that Newt Gingrich helped to create. He got to take those divisions that were created by the 1990s, those divisions that were made apparent to the country with that 2000 election, with that 2000 election map, that red-blue divide. Donald Trump came along, took that red-blue divide that had now been subjected to the war in Iraq, to 9/11, to the Great Recession. He took that country that had been through that, that was divided like that, and he offered it. He offered it Trumpism, which, of course, had been Buchananism in the 90s. And in that world, that sort of post-Bush, post-9/11, post-2000 world, Trump found the ability to do what Buchanan couldn't, not just to scare the Republican establishment, but to upend it entirely, and not just to get to the general election, but to win it narrowly as possible. But that's sort of the point of the world that was created by the 90s. Elections are won around the margins now. We don't have 49 state landslides. We don't have electoral maps that are all one color. We don't have people that go to the polls and vote for a Democrat for this office and a Republican for that office. We have two parties that go into every general election, you know, basically guaranteed at least 45% of the vote, fighting over an increasingly tiny pool of swing voters, and really just generally more interested in finding ways to motivate their own voters and to try to outnumber the other guy by just enough votes on election day. That's the political terrain that emerged from the 90s. That was not the political terrain when the decade began. That was not the political terrain for the generation before it, at least. But it is now. And it's the world that Donald Trump, I think, he was very well suited for that world. Whatever you think of him, I think he's very well suited for that political world.
Now, I'm going to put you in the TV world of time crunch here. In about, I don't know, a minute or so, I want to hit one last thing in your book, which is that 1992 race where you delve into Ross Perot's candidacy and the impact he had, and he was in and out of the campaign, but then he was a participant in all three presidential debates. And I'm wondering, do you think someone like that could surface in 2020 or in the future, a third-party candidate?
You know, I look at Perot and I look at Trump. And Trump didn't do it as a third-party candidate, but in a way he did. He almost invaded the Republican Party and took it over. What Perot was in a way what Trump was. He was a populist billionaire. It's a sort of a paradox, right? But Perot didn't have the same abrasiveness as Trump did, but Perot showed the potential appeal of the wildly successful businessman outsider who talks about how broken the system is, who talks about his unique ability to fix it, who has an ability to stir up sort of a populist uprising against the entire political establishment. You know, I think Trump ended up pursuing it through the Republican Party, but it really was a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. No endorsements from Republican leaders, Republicans openly denouncing him, National Review running a full, you know, cover saying never Trump or against Trump or whatever exactly the wording was there. So in some ways, I think we saw it. And I do remember It was a former Perot spokesman at the end.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. I had to cut you off. Steve Kornacki, thanks so much for joining us on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.